Sales of canning supplies have been soaring for the last 3 years, in spite of the recession. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The interest in canning may be driven by a desire to save money. It could be the result of the growing market for fresh and organic foods. Or it could just be the latest trend among foodies and hipsters. But no doubt about it, canning is making a comeback. Today, we'll talk about putting up jams, jellies, pickles, and produce with Jill Weber of Iowa State University Extension. And thousands of animals have spent the last week at the Iowa State Fair. If one of those animals gets into trouble, Dr. Bruce Lucian is the man they go to see. We'll meet the official State Fair veterinarian and take your calls after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sales of ball canning jars are up almost 10% this year over last year. And last year, they were up 30% over the year before. Canning is hot right now, but nobody knows why. It could be a reaction to the slow economy. It could be an outgrowth of the growing market for local and organic foods, or it could just be a trend. Maybe knitting is out and canning is in. But any way you look at it, women like my guest today are finding that their canning expertise is in high demand. Jill Weber is a nutrition and health program specialist with Iowa State University Extension based in Black Hawk County. Hello, Jill.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Have you been getting a lot of requests for canning, I guess, canning expertise?
Our offices do get calls this time of year asking for proper food safety information. So, yes, we do.
Have you seen an increase?
I would say yes. There is an increase in people wanting to learn that have not done any food preservation. And we also regularly get calls from people wanting to know how to fix a particular problem they had. So, yes, I would say there's an increased interest.
What kinds of foods can be canned?
Fruits and vegetables, I think, are the one that I think of most, but people can can meat, and there's just lots of different foods.
I know that fruits and vegetables, often, especially fruits, are very high in acid, and I think that makes them very amenable to being canned. Why does that make the process simpler?
Well, when you're canning the high acid foods, you can use a water bath canner, and that is a little bit easier to do, I would say. It's still important to follow the proper procedures and use a tested recipe. The low acid vegetables would need to be pressure canned.
All right, and what's the difference? Can you walk us through what you need to do when you do a water bath canning, and then we'll go through the high pressure steps?
Okay, with a water bath can, what you're doing is using a large kettle, and then the product is completely submerged in water and needs to have an inch over the top. And with a pressure canner, it's a different process.
All right, and then how does a pressure canner work?
With a pressure canner, you're counting on the pressure to raise the temperature, and so there's only 2 inches of water in the bottom of the kettle, and you need to bring the pressure up, and you're using a high pressure situation.
When you're using a pressure canning device, what kinds of things are you trying to guard against? What are your fears?
Botulism.
All right. Well, that's pretty scary
yeah.
in and of itself. Are there any other dangers?
There's other pathogens or things that could be in the product. So you're wanting to get it to a higher temperature, and that's not possible with a water bath canner. So kind of killing the enzymes and getting the product to a higher temperature that only a pressure canner can reach.
Why do you think canning food is a good option?
It's a way to preserve your high-quality produce and enjoy it throughout the year. The growing season is short, and so people who like to garden and grow their own food would only have it available to them for a short period of time. So by doing some food preservation, you can enjoy it through the winter.
There are other food preservation options, though, like freezing, for example. Why would you choose canning over freezing?
Actually, I wouldn't.
Okay.
I enjoy doing freezing. There are some people I know that like canned green beans better than frozen green beans, for example. So a lot of it might be personal preference. Things like jams and jellies and salsas People would probably like the quality of that maybe a little bit better than freezing, for example.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about some of the different kinds of things that we can, and maybe you can give us a little bit of advice. But we'd also love for you to join the conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you're new to canning, let us know why you decided to take it up and what kinds of things you've been working on. If you've been canning for a long time, give us a call and let us know what keeps you coming back every year and what you like to stock your pantry with. Also, if you have any questions, Jill would be happy to help out. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. Now, I recently had my first canning experience, at least as an adult. I helped my mom a little bit a long time ago, but as an adult, I just made some cherry jam for the very first time, which was a very simple canning process. But can you walk us through what the process is when you're making a jam or a jelly, something like that, and you are sealing it in jars?
Okay. The first thing you want to start with is high-quality fruit. The canning process isn't going to improve the quality. So if you're using, if you're wanting to make jam, start with the freshest product that you can get. And then you would want to use a tested recipe. Pectin will be important. So you have many choices. You can use powdered pectin or liquid pectin. It is possible with some jams and jellies, like of a higher pectin fruit, like a plum, for example, you wouldn't have to add added pectin, but in most cases you will. Then you'll want to use a tested recipe and follow the recipe exactly. You're going to be adding some acid, some sugar, and some fruit to the product to make your jam or jelly. You'll need to use all the entire amount of sugar that the recipe calls for in order to have a high-quality product. You'll also want to have jars that have been sanitized, sterilized, and you can do that in a dishwasher, but you want to have clean jars and lids. It's important when you're canning to use new lids. You don't want to keep those over year after year. You use them one time, and then you want to purchase new ones each year just to make sure you've got the highest chance of a quality seal. You're going to a lot of work doing your canning, and so you want to make sure that you're using proper jars that are canning jars. You don't want to use jars that are like mayonnaise jars or that type of thing, simply because they weren't meant for canning. And when you do the processing, putting them down in the water, they have a chance that you could have breakage. So your highest chance of success would be to use canning jars.
And they're a little more rugged?
Yes. You need a two-piece lid. And then you're going to need to process the jam or jelly in a water bath canner. It doesn't work. You might get a seal. I've heard of people that put it in the jars, put the lid on it, and flip it over. And they say, well, it seals. Well, a sealed jar isn't necessarily a safe jar. So you do need to process it in a water bath canner.
Okay, and with the water bath canner, again, this is a large pot with simmering water.
Yes.
And you submerge the bottle or the jar in that.
Down in the water, yes.
Uh-huh. All right. David is on the line in Cedar Rapids. He called 866-780-9100. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just recently started canning, probably since about the beginning of the year. I'm still working on getting my own pressure cooker. I go over to Grandma's now whenever I want to do some canning. But as far as when you had the freezing versus canning, I like to can because you can keep it for a lot longer. In my freezer, if I keep, say, meats or vegetables in the freezer, they'll only last for 6 months to a year, whereas I can keep cans in my pantry for 4 or 5 years as long as they're sealed properly. And I actually prefer to can more meats like beef and chicken that I've diced up. Keep that in my pantry when I can find them on sale, you know, when you get them really cheaply at the store, buy a whole bunch and can it up so you'll have it when I need it.
Now, I have heard people complain about the flavor of canned meats. David, what do you like about canned meat?
I guess I just like the convenience. I haven't really noticed a whole lot of difference. I mean, you do need, It does tend to get a bit salty because you need a little bit more salt to can your meat. But I guess I haven't noticed a huge... I take the difference with more of the convenience over a taste difference because I'm not just going to be eating the meat straight when I have it in, say, soups or something like that. I don't really notice much of a difference.
What got you into canning?
Well, I mean, I always grew up with grandma's can sitting in the pantry, and I decided that it was time that I learned how to do it. I'm getting out on my own, trying to get everything together, and I decided that it's just a great way to make sure that I always have something on hand that I need.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for your call.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And Lynette is on the line from Keosauqua. Hello, Lynette.
Hi.
Why do you can?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I can for so that I can can my own organic food since we garden a lot, and organic food is kind of expensive to buy, and so for one, it's kind of cost effective to can our sweet corn and our green beans, and we do a lot of freezing as well, though. The other thing that I've noticed is that I'm a bit of a food snob anymore. And, my spaghetti sauce over, what I would buy at the grocery store is expensive. But if I make it, it's not. And yet, I guess, it's also just a, you can put into it whatever you want, and you can make it as good or, as you want, and I don't have to settle for cheap tasting spaghetti sauce and salsa. It's really, really good. And
have you found that you've been able to save money because of canning? Some people talk about trying to save money and then they spend so much money on equipment that it doesn't really save them money. Has it saved you money?
Oh yeah. The investment in the jars and the canners, usually, canners are kind of expensive to get going, but, I've had mine 5 years. I think it cost me $50 when I got it. And the jars, oftentimes, especially here in Iowa, you can find jars at auctions and, if you don't necessarily have to buy brand new jars at, the hardware store or wherever, you can go and look for good deals. I normally have to buy, jam jars, but I barely ever have to buy mason jars at full price.
All right. Well, Lynette, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Take care.
Jill, when somebody's getting started, what do they need to do? We have just a couple seconds left before the break. And so what's the first thing that they need to get?
If they have their canner, I want to encourage them to go to their county extension office and have the lid tested for a pressure canner.
Okay, so that's the number one safety tip.
And yes.
We will talk more about equipment and getting started in a moment. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Jill Weber, a nutrition and health program specialist with Iowa State University Extension in Black Hawk County. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is Jill Weber. She's a nutrition and health program specialist with Iowa State University Extension based in Black Hawk County. And today we're talking about canning. If you're new to canning, give us a call and tell us why you started. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And if you have any questions, problems that you've run into, Jill would be happy to help out with that as well. 866-780-9100. Jill, before the break, you mentioned that it's important if you're doing pressure canning to get the lid of your canning machine checked. Why is that so important?
The dial gauge, the weighted gauges will remain accurate and don't need to be tested. But people that are using pressure canners that have a dial gauge, we want to make sure that the dial is registering at 10 pounds of pressure, for example, and it really is 10 pounds of pressure. So when they get it tested, the dial is checked against our tester unit that we have checked every year. So it's a way to make sure that you're really getting up to the pressure that you think you are.
And we talked briefly about the simple water bath canning techniques. Can you walk me through the process with a pressure canner?
Okay, with a pressure canner, you would be doing the same thing. You want to start with high quality product and use clean jars, and you would be using a tested recipe and recipes from, for example, from the Extension Service, from the National Food Preservation Site. They have a cookbook called So Easy to Preserve, or Ball Canning, for example. They have good information, too. So use a tested recipe, and then you'll be making your product, and you want to fill the jars. The directions will tell you how much headspace to use. That's very important. And you put the lids on, the two-piece lids, and then you're going to put the product down in the pressure canner. And it's usually 2 to 3 inches of water you would put in the bottom. And then you're going to bring the unit up to pressure and make sure that you keep it at pressure for the amount of time that the particular item needs, and let it cool down and let it cool and make sure that the jar is sealed.
You've mentioned several times the importance of using a tested recipe, and obviously many of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers didn't necessarily have tested recipes. Why is that so important?
To make sure, we talked earlier about the pH level, and to make sure that, like with salsas, you don't have too much low acid ingredients, like more onions than what you should. If you use a tested recipe, it'll tell you how many cups of peppers or onions and tomatoes to use, to make sure that you're keeping the pH of the product at a level that will give you a safe product in the end. So you want to use a tested recipe.
Okay. Teresa is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Teresa.
Hi.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, my fiance and I both do canning. He has been canning chicken and beef for probably 3 or 4 years. And I can applesauce, pears, I do cranberry relish, I do summertime fruits, a bunch of different things.
What got you started?
Well, I just remember my mother canning pickled beets in the kitchen and her being purple up to her elbows, and always marveled at, you know, months later it was always there and it's always fresh, and I just loved it. And not for the convenience, you know, of the meat, like my fiancé does beef and chicken, we can just go to the cupboard and pull out, you know, roast beef or chicken, and we can have tacos in 10 minutes. And it's very convenient.
Well, it's convenient to have. Is it convenient to spend all the time doing the canning up front?
It's time efficient. You do a whole bunch at one time, and it's in the cupboard. So, you know, it's just, it only takes like 2 or 3 hours to do up to maybe 20 jars of canned chicken.
All right. Oh, and Teresa, did you both can before you met, or is that something you got into together?
No, we both canned before we met. It was a happy coincidence. I opened his cupboard one day, and here's all this canned chicken and meat, which I've never done. And I said, oh, did your mother do this? And he says, no, I do it. I love to do it, and it's just really good. And he waits until there's a really good special on chicken, like 99 cents a pound. He'll buy 30 pounds of chicken and can it all at once, and it's good for a year. So it's a happy coincidence that we just love to do it.
All right. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yep, thanks a lot. Well, Jill, in an informal survey, I would say that pretty much everybody who's been calling the show falls into that new demographic of young canners. Are you hearing from more and more young people who want to find out about this?
I would say yes. People, there is a renewed interest, and that's exciting to me.
And do you hold classes for people who are interested?
Actually, I have one coming up Tuesday, August 31st at the Blackhawk County Extension Office. It'll be from 5:30 to 7:30, and it's a class that's meant for someone who's just newly interested and wanting to learn how to can, and it would also be a good refresher for someone who's been canning.
And probably extension offices around the state would be doing similar things.
You could go online and just search and possibly find one. And if an office isn't offering one, they will be able to help you find one that maybe is.
All right. Peter is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Peter.
Hi. I can only jam. I don't have any expensive equipment, just the stuff in the kitchen.
I collect like mulberries when they're in season, or elderberries or whatnot. Make small batches, maybe 2 quarts. Reuse jam and jelly jars that I've gotten from stores. But then I store it in the refrigerator. And so it's not as essential that everything be super sterile and so forth. And I use a low-sugar pectin formula so I can kind of keep the sugar down. But, you know, people don't have to go into this thing whole hog and invest $50 and so forth to get their foot in the water. And I'm not part of the younger generation being over 70, but anyway, I thought I would relate my experience.
Well, it sounds like you do some pretty creative jams, and we were talking about tested recipes earlier, but I'll bet you've made up a few of your own recipes.
Yes, I, you know, normally the pectin box comes with a whole list of recipes for different fruits, and they never include mulberry and elderberry and the wild things that I pick around Iowa City here, so I have to do a little experimenting. But again, since I store it in the refrigerator, you know, it doesn't have to be perfectly sterile and meet all the standards that your guest perhaps expects.
All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your call. And Jill, what's your response to that? Is that a good alternative, or is it a good idea just to, I mean, because you don't need necessarily a special pot to boil a jar with a lid on it in.
I think it's wonderful what he's doing, and I applaud him keeping it in the refrigerator. That's wonderful.
All right. The number to call is 866-780-9100. We have a couple more minutes, and Kurt is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Kurt.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I just want to let your listeners know that the Field to Family Festival is coming up in Iowa City in September, and one of the guests that will be there is Sherry Brooks Vinton, who's just released a book called Put 'Em Up, which is an absolute Bible for all sorts of food preservation, not just canning. And there's information about it at the Johnson County Local Food Alliance website, jclfa.org. She'll be here September 3rd and 4th.
Okay, well, thanks for the tip, Kurt.
You bet. Thank you.
And Pat is on the line in Iowa City, canning dill pickles right now, Pat.
Yeah, I am. They're in processing. I just read on the back of the bowl, lid insert this morning, 15 minutes. I always have done mine for 5. Anyway, the reason I can is because I can't find a dill pickle that tastes as good as mine. If I ever can, I won't have to go through all this.
And you would stop if you could find a dill pickle that
I
suits
would,
your...
I would, but it's so nice you don't have to deal with preservatives, and even though there's plenty of salt in the brine, you get a good quality product. You can pick your pickles when they're just the right size. It's just kind of a forever tradition.
All right. Well, Pat, thank you so much. Enjoy your pickles.
Thank you.
And Jill, there is conflicting advice about how long you should leave a can in the water bath. Who do you trust?
I would recommend the National Center for Home Food Preservation. They have excellent information online. The County Extension Office, that we have publications. There's one on making pickled products. And then, like I mentioned, the National Center has a cookbook, So Easy to Preserve. Those are, and the Ball, one of your listeners mentioned that. That's another good source.
All right. So there should be plenty of advice out there if you're looking for information. Jill, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jill Weber is a nutrition and health program specialist with Iowa State University Extension based in Black Hawk County. And coming up in about 5 minutes, we're going to meet the official Iowa State Fair veterinarian, Dr. Bruce Lucian, coming up after the break. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And every year, thousands of animals visit the Iowa State Fair. Before the fair even starts, the barns start to fill up with animals of all varieties. We're being visited by some sheep right now. They've traveled from all over the state. And if any of the animals there need to see a vet during the fair, chances are pretty good they will see Dr. Bruce Lucian. He is a professor of veterinary science at Iowa State University and the lead veterinarian for the Iowa State Fair. Hello, Dr. Lucian.
How are you doing this morning, Charity?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am fine. We're having nonstop fun at the fair.
Well, that's great to hear. So how many animals actually go to the fair? I know when you go and visit, the barns are all full, but how many animals actually come through during the week?
Oh, that's a great question. We have barns fill up and empty out several times throughout the fair. The word is that we probably have around 15,000 animals that show up at the fair.
Wow. And every variety thinkable. I mean, I know you see all of the regular kind of animals, the pigs and the cows and the chickens, but what are some of the more unusual varieties that you take care of during the fair?
Well, we will get a display of rabbits at the fair. We have a lot of goats that are now coming to the fair as the fair is starting to come closer to a close. Dairy goats, meat goats are coming in. And, you know, one of the things that I always enjoy looking at is, you know, right now we have the draft horses coming in. They're beautiful, large animals, and they're fun to for the exhibitors and for the people that come to the fair to go and see.
How long have you been doing this at the fair?
This is my fourth year. First year I worked with Dr. Keith Miller that had been the fair veterinarian for probably 15 years. And so this is my fourth year, third year alone.
What is a typical day like for you working at the fair?
Well, we will get up early. We will get up and start seeing animals, and it depends on the day. We will go out and walk barns. We'll have some regulatory issues and some other things that we do just to follow the rules of exhibition and the show ring code of ethics that are at the fair. And then we will have people that will come to us with you know, some ailments that they might have with some animals, and we will go out and see those specific animals and help them out.
When you talk about regulatory issues, what kinds of things do you need to look for?
Well, there are rules of exhibition that the state has, and those rules are built so that we do not have, you know, a transfer of disease. You know, people that bring their healthy animals that come to the fair, hopefully they are not in contact with other animals that might bring something there. So that is the type of thing that we look for, make sure that the animals have been inspected by the hometown veterinarian first, and then they'll come check in with us.
Do you ever have to send animals home?
Once in a while, unfortunately, and that's one of the hardest things that I deal with, is sometimes something might show up and you know, it's something that crops up disease-wise, and unfortunately, that's a hard thing for the exhibitor.
The animals that come to the fair, of course, they've just gone through travel. Now they're in a strange place. They're in a barn full of other animals, really packed in many cases. Is this a really stressful experience for a lot of animals?
Well, it is, and you've really described that well. And once they come, especially like last week, we had a lot of heat and humidity. The temperature humidity index was high, and they come, and they're already maybe overheated from the travel. And it takes a little time for that to all work out, just like our own body systems. The animals have the same type of troubles that can occur.
You also mentioned show ring ethics. What do you need to do to uphold show ring ethics?
Well, and our state fair is a well-run operation. There's you know, this fair has been going on for lots of years. We have FFA and 4-H kids that come in, the open class, so the people are very accustomed to and know the ethics that occur there. And so that is a thing that's probably a minor thing that I get involved with, and so the state fair people usually deal with those issues.
Do you have to do any drug testing of the animals that have been brought in to make sure that they're not given things to boost their growth that they're not supposed to be given, et cetera?
Yes, actually, we do some of that. There's some random samples that we will take from some animals, and then the champions of some of the livestock classes, we will also do some testing on the champion and the reserve grand champion.
And have you ever discovered that somebody was cheating?
Oh, once in a while that happens, but for the most part, you know, everything is clean. You know, they know coming in that there is a chance that that could happen with their animal. And so it's something that we look at and deal with. And I think that's all part of the show industry.
I'm talking with Dr. Bruce Lucian. He is the Iowa State veterinarian, the official state fair, the official veterinarian of the Iowa State Fair. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions or if you've had some experiences at the fair, if you have some stories about animals you've spent a week with in the barns there at the fair. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, of course, the people who bring these animals to the fair, often they'll actually stay with them in the barn or, you know, camp nearby, stay nearby. People are watching their animals pretty closely, aren't they?
Oh, they do. You know, the exhibitors, you know, they are in this because they love to show their animals and they love to take care of their animals. And it is not surprising to walk through the barn and people be sleeping on cots. And some days I wonder how they do that. But they have a lot of fun. It's a great experience for our state's youth and families that they can enjoy the experience to come to a state fair like this and display the what they love to display.
How do people find you if they're concerned about something with their animal?
Yeah, we have a vet office actually on the fairgrounds. It's in the cattle barn between it's across the street from the swine barn. So it's a kind of a central location with all the livestock barns that are there. And then, of course, all the different barns have superintendents of those barns. So if they have a problem, they can come directly to us or they might go to the barn superintendents who will get a hold of us.
Can you give me an example of some of the things you've been treating in the last couple of days?
Well, I had a very interesting case. I had a little miniature horse that came in, a beautiful little animal, came in nice and healthy. The animal was described by the owners having a great appetite, and they went off themselves after they got here to eat. The little miniature horse was in the a stall. There were wood chips in there, and by golly, he ate just a pack of wood chips, and it got caught in his esophagus. And we could describe this as a choke condition. And so that was kind of an interesting case. We'll get a lot
what,
of
what did you do
animals.
For him?
Well, ultimately, we ended up sending him up to the Iowa State University Lloyd Veterinary Medical Center to the hospital. We actually passed the stomach hose, tried to relieve this choke, and I think the best situation was what we did. We sent him up there, and the horse is doing well now, and the owner's happy.
Oh, wow. That seems like such a crazy thing to happen
the
minute
surprise,
you get to
yes.
the fair. What are some of the other cases you've been seeing?
Well, we deal with a lot of things that might come with the heat and humidity and the animals that get dehydrated. Sometimes there's travel injuries. You know, they might ride 2 to 3 hours in a trailer to get here. And, you know, I just was working with someone in a swine barn. They had a pig that kind of tweaked a muscle in the back leg. And, you know, those little injuries caused some lameness. And so we deal with a lot of those type of things.
At the bar or at the fair, they also have a Miracle of Life Pavilion where kids can go in and, well, everyone can go in and see baby animals, see eggs hatching, and even possibly see a cow giving birth, that kind of really amazing experience. Do you oversee that at all, or is that separate from your duties?
That is separate from my duties. Dr. Gene Hoy comes in and he takes care of that. That is the Animal Learning Center is a great opportunity, I think, to help teach our people that come to the fair about just exactly what you described, animals giving birth, chickens hatching. We do have some sows in there giving birth to pigs. We have some sheep and goat in there and, of course, cows. And that's a great experience and a great place to visit when you're at the fair.
In your work at Iowa State University, what kinds of animals do you usually interact with?
Most of my experience or work that I do at Iowa State University has to deal with cattle, dairy cows, and beef. I also do a lot of swine work and some sheep and goats.
So when you get down to the fair and you're working with a lot greater variety of animals, do you have to study up on your poultry knowledge, for example, to be able to take care of the animals in the poultry barn?
Well, fortunately, I spent 23 years in private practice, and that experience and then also being a farm boy growing up probably gives me a variety of experiences that I've had in the past and a chance to deal with. But yes, you know, there's always times when you come by something and you say, okay, I need to do a little research on that event. So it's not uncommon. I do bring some of my manuals and books along with me in case there's some unusual thing that I need to deal with.
And it sounds like unusual things happen at the fair all the time.
It sure can. Nonstop fun.
You've been at this for 4 years. What made you want to work at the state fair?
Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about private practice was working with families, working with their children, and getting to know them. And coming to the fair, it's a great experience to see the families come in with their livestock, see the kids come in. I get to enjoy that relationship with them and help them out, and that's one of the things I love to do.
We have a few minutes left. If you'd like to call and join our conversation, you can. The number is 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you've shown animals at the Iowa State Fair and had a medical emergency, tell us your story, 866-780-9100. Or if you have any questions for Dr. Lucian, 866-780-9100. What's the strangest case that you've had so far this year?
I would say probably the miniature horse that I described before. Some of the other things have been, you know, fairly routine that we've dealt with. One of the strange things that I had last year, I spent all night up in the barn with a bloated steer that ended up not being able to show at that fair, but went on to show at Exarban, I think, down at the Royal exhibit down in Kansas City. So we're always dealing with some things that take a little more time and work, and one of the other avenues or things that I get to do is bring some senior veterinary students and another associate veterinarian down with me. And so when you asked what was some of the reasons that I did it, you know, also the experience that these senior veterinary students get while they're down here at the fair is a tremendous for them also.
What do you think they can learn from this experience that they wouldn't get in the classroom?
Well, sometimes it's just regular clinical experience, you know, the chance to go out and work on some things that they might not get to, you know, it's hands-on type experience, but then also to see some of the things that happen at the fair. You know, the overheated, the heat exhaustion type things. We will deal with a variety of other ailments that anytime they get hands-on experience, it's good for them.
You mentioned the bloated steer that you stayed up with. What ended up being wrong with that?
It was an animal that had a what we call a bloat, and it had a frothy bloat. I gave him several medications orally to relieve this bloat. Had passed the stomach hose down in him. Sometimes because of the rumen microflora or the bugs in the rumen, they can produce a frothy type bloat that can cause a very extended abdomen and make it difficult for him. But that animal turned out okay.
You mentioned that it went on to show at a number of different places. It seems like if I were the owner of a steer like that, I think I'd be a little gun-shy of taking it anywhere else. Why do you think people are so driven to take their animals to events like this?
Well, I think they know the experience. They've invested a lot of time and energy into an animal, and they've got something that they're proud of. Something that they want to exhibit at some place, and I think it's just a great experience for the family, for the youth, and I think they're driven to do it because of that.
In your interactions with families, is this an educational opportunity for you to inform, especially some of the young people who are showing their animals in the fair, to tell them a little bit about veterinary science and veterinary medicine?
Sure. Yeah. Just the other day, I met this family that they were displaying and had a hog that I was looking at. And one of the daughters right away, she spoke up and said, I want to be a veterinarian. And it was fun to interact with that family and talk about what we were doing with their hog. And she was just bright-eyed and said she's going to go to Iowa State University to vet school.
I know that there has been a tremendous amount of growth in the number of small animal vets around the country. Do you find that it's hard to get people excited about large animal veterinary medicine or farm vets?
No, I don't. We've actually, at Iowa State, we've gone through recruiting. We know that there has been somewhat of a shortage of people that are doing, and we've got a generation of retiring veterinarians out there. But at Iowa State University, I would say that we have a great percentage of our students that are now interested in large animal medicine, and I think we'll do a great job for our state to fulfill that.
I think for a lot of us, when we think about large animal medicine, we probably think about all creatures great and small and James Harriet. What is the life of a large animal vet like today?
Well, probably somewhat like that. In rural Iowa, you get to see a variety of things, and I've always said variety is a spice of life. And so there will be days that you might be working, cattle, and some veterinarians do a lot of cattle work. But, you know, tomorrow there might be something else going on with someone with sheep or someone with hogs. And so that's always a lot of fun when you get to experience a lot of different things and help families out.
You still get a lot of calls in the middle of the night?
Probably not as much as I did 23 years ago when I was just graduating from veterinary medicine in 1983. It seemed like we would get some more calls in the middle of the night, but you never know. I mean, it can still happen, and when you can go out and help someone out in the middle of the night, that's gratifying on the way home.
Now, of course, most of us, our interactions with veterinarians are limited to small animal veterinarians. And I have noticed over the past 10 years that prices have risen a lot as far as getting treatment for your small animals. Has there been that kind of shift with large animal veterinary medicine as well?
I would say that the price has probably gone with the market of the animals, and I would not say there's been a huge shift in that. I think the veterinary profession has been very keen on helping our producers and livestock out, and then of course there's always the need to make a living.
Right, of course. And I'm wondering what the changes in large animal veterinary medicine have been in the last couple of decades. I mean, you've been at this for quite some time.
Well, we have technologies that we can take out now and enjoy. Ultrasound is always something that we can go out on a routine basis and utilize now. So that's probably one of the technologies that we've done. But there's always new technologies in pharmaceuticals and biologicals that we can utilize to help, I think, safeguard and treat our animals out there.
So you've been at the state fair for 4 years now. Is this something that you're going to keep doing for the long term?
That's a good question. Tomorrow I'll wake up and take a look at the experience. I enjoy it. 2 weeks is something that at the end of 2 weeks you say, wow, that was an experience that I need to consider for next year. So I think I will, but we'll see how that goes.
Does it take a little while for you to get over the memory of how hot it was and how crowded it was before you start thinking about the next year?
Actually, Monday when I drove down last week, it seemed like I hadn't left from last year. And so it's a unique experience that is fun. There's some challenges that go along with it, but it's something that I do enjoy.
What's your favorite part of it?
My favorite part, I was thinking about that. And of course, helping the families and working with my students that are down here, I enjoy that. One of the things that I've gone and exhibited myself, or actually had to go take a look at, that I'm always amazed is the chickens that show up in some of our 4-H, FFA, and open class shows, and they are just brilliantly colored. They're beautiful, a lot of varieties, and to me it really displays the glory and creativity of our God.
And you've been a poultry exhibitor yourself in the past?
No, I have not done that myself. Growing up, we did have chickens on the farm, but no, I have not displayed or exhibited, but I do have to go up and examine and make sure everything's okay. And when I walk in the barn and just see the brilliant colors on display, that's really a lot of fun.
You get to see a lot of things that you don't necessarily see in the typical barnyard.
That is true. Yes, it is.
So what is your favorite, if you can say, what is your favorite animal to work with at the fair?
I would say probably the dairy animals. The dairy cows is one of the things I grew up on a dairy farm and spent a lot of my career doing. They're an incredible animal that we see. It's early on in the fair when they come. They're beautiful animals. They you know, something. I do have still a lot of clients that bring cows down, but probably the dairy cows.
Of course, a lot of people come to the fair to see the animals, and a lot of people come to the fair to see all of the other stuff as well. But if people who are not familiar with farms make their way over to the animal pavilions, what do you think they should be looking for and maybe help their kids get out of that experience?
Well, one of the great places that I think the North Polk FFA chapter does, they have the Avenue of Breeds that's right across the street from me. They can walk through that area and see just a variety of species, a variety of breeds that come in. We have horses on display. We have poultry on display, sheep, goats, cattle, miniature cows. So they can walk through, and actually we have an elk and an ostrich in there. So that's probably one of the hits that they'll want to go to. And then obviously the Animal Learning Center is a lot of fun. But, you know, when you walk through even like the horse barn and you see the big draft horses and how big and enormous they are, and you turn around a corner and there's miniature horses there and they're, you know, not even hip high, that's a lot of fun. But there's just so many things to see there.
All right. Dr. Lucian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Dr. Bruce Lucian is a professor of veterinary science at Iowa State University, and he is also the official vet of the Iowa State Fair. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support today from Phil Moss in Cedar Falls and John Pemble in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime if there's something you'd like to hear on the show. If you know someone with a great story to tell, let us know. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day. We're going to talk about how the rains this year have impacted fruit trees, gardens, and crops. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.